You are listening to a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. Any opinions expressed within are solely those of the participants and do not reflect the views of WRCT Radio Incorporated. Questions and comments can be addressed to the Public Affairs Director at pa@wrct.org or by calling 412-621-0728.
Hello and welcome to the Digital Hazard on this, the 10th of April, 2011. Shout out to my girlfriend because it's her birthday today. But we have a special guest on our show, Tom Merritt of Twit TV.
Hello.
Hello. Eric, you're here too, right?
I am here.
All right. Tom, how about you just give us a quick introduction of yourself?
Sure. I do a podcast for Leo Laporte's This Week in Tech Network, hence the Twit in twit.tv. The main show that I do is called Tech News Today. It's daily at 5:30 Eastern time. We stream it out live, put it out as a podcast, and it's a collection of all of the technology news of the day discussed with our in-house hosts, and we usually bring on some guest experts to help us figure out stuff as well. And I do a bunch of other shows and podcasts, mostly around technology, and I also do a book review show about science fiction and fantasy books called Sword and Laser, and generally just mess around on the internet.
Well, that's sounds like fun. And you get paid to do it too, right?
Yes. Well, most of it.
Yeah. All right. Well, do you want to talk a little bit about your career? Like, this is an interview with you. So how about a little bit of your career history? You started off as a DJ for a country music station outside of Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, we could go farther back.
Oh, okay. If you want to go farther back.
I started doing musical variety shows in elementary school.
Oh, okay.
My first job was at WGEL in Greenville, Illinois, where I grew up.
Okay.
So I got a job doing the weekends and then eventually doing some weekdays, and that's where I got my experience in radio. It was a country music station during the day and a rock station at night.
Okay. So you were
actually a metal station at night.
Oh dear.
So at 8 o'clock every night, it went from the best country in the country to the rock zone, and we played Black Lace and Metallica and all kinds of crazy stuff.
Okay.
And so I worked there from 1986 until I graduated high school in 1988. And then I moved to Champaign, Illinois. I went to school at the University of Illinois and got a job there at WPGU, where I was a DJ. I was the sports director for a while, and then I was a program director for 2 years.
Okay.
And that was a rock station, just a regular rock station. It was run mostly by students. They had a general manager who was full-time and a sales manager who was full-time. It was not owned by the university, though. It was an independent radio station. It's kind of a weird mix. Not a college station, but also not a totally, you know, private station. But it was commercial, so it was a real station, and we were the number one rock station in the city of Champaign-Urbana.
Oh wow, okay.
And then I don't know, you want me to keep going?
Yeah, sure, just keep going. You went to Tech TV for a while, right?
Oh yeah, I haven't got there yet.
Oh okay.
So then I worked at Pizza Hut. Yeah, so I went from radio in college. I went to grad school at the University of Texas at Austin. Kicked around in Austin for about 6 years. Doing lots of various different things.
Okay.
An access television show and some pirate radio and crazy stuff. And then, yeah, 1999, a friend of mine was out in San Francisco and said, hey, there's tons of jobs out here. You should move out to San Francisco. So I moved out, applied for 3 jobs, got all 3 of them, and decided to pick the one at ZDTV, being an associate producer for their website, for a show called The Screensavers, which was hosted by Leo Laporte and Kate Patello.
Okay.
And then I worked my way up. Actually, I don't feel like so much as I worked my way up is that I lasted while everyone else got laid off and eventually became executive producer of the techtv.com website. ZDTV changed its name to Tech TV
Okay.
during that time. And then when Comcast bought Tech TV and shut down all but a handful of its shows, I didn't make the move down to Los Angeles. They merged it into their network called G4. I stayed in San Francisco and caught on at CNET and did some weird stuff at CNET the first year I was there. But among those weird things was starting podcasting for them. So I started doing a show called Buzz Out Loud with Molly Wood and helped to launch the CNET TV property with Molly and Mark Larkin and a bunch of other folks, and worked there until last year.
Yeah.
And then last year in May, I left CNET to go work for Leo.
All right. I can tell you that I definitely followed you through Buzz Out Loud and CNET TV. And then I've been jumping back and forth between BOL and Tech News Today for
basically
for the show notes. But no, yeah, I mean, what Eric and I do to get show notes for our show, I mean, obviously we don't do it every day. It's a weekly thing. But we sort of comb through the stories that you and Molly talk about between, I mean, like two properties.
Well, and it's funny. I actually keep an eye on what Buzz Out Loud does because we're sort of the evening. Tech News Today is the evening news to Buzz Out Loud's sort of
midday,
not necessarily morning news, but they're midday on the East Coast. And so I don't want to duplicate everything so that folks like you who want to listen to both and get two different perspectives on the news at least get something unique. And I hope that shows through because there is a lot of different tech news and a lot of different ways to cover it.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely agree. So, Eric, do you have anything that popped up on the top of your mind? Do you want to ask?
No, I wish I had as colorful a history in jobs as that. There's a wide range of array there, Tom.
When you get to be my age, you don't have a colorful history.
No, I just think it speaks to, you know, it credits your experience. You know, it gives you some experience to be able to speak towards all the tech out there.
Well, one of the reasons that I took the job at ZDTV when I moved out to San Francisco was because it combined a lot of different things that I enjoyed doing. I had gotten a Texas Instruments computer in 1982 and taught myself to program in BASIC, and then I moved on to a Commodore 64 and I created my own fantasy baseball league on the Commodore 64, and I did all kinds of computer stuff. But then I went into journalism through radio, and when I saw the ZDTV job, and I also created my own website, by the way, in the late 90s in Austin. I was running a website that was a parody news site. So when I saw ZDTV, I was like, well, I can work on the web. I'll be in journalism. I can do. There's TV. There's online radio, and it's about computers and technology. It's like perfect. It's
it
everything
just a
marriage
of everything you wanted to do. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So did you major in journalism or some journalism type field throughout college and graduate school, or were you more
University of
side?
Illinois? I graduated with a BS in journalism.
Okay.
Almost exactly what it sounds like. And I don't know why at Illinois they give you a bachelor's of science in journalism because they consider it a practical degree versus a liberal arts degree is more of an artistic degree, and so they give you a BA for that, but they give you a BS for journalism.
Okay.
versus if you go into the master's program at Illinois, you get a Master of the Arts in Journalism because the master's program focuses more on studying media and why things happen the way they do and media studies, whereas the journalism program at Illinois is very nuts and bolts. It's reporting, you know, going out and actually doing reporting. So when I went to the University of Texas, I went into the journalism school there, and it was kind of a mistake because their master's program at UT was very much a nuts and bolts journalism program, and I wanted to do something different than what they were advocating.
Okay, I mean, I know that University of Illinois UC has a very strong computer science program that's probably come up over the recent years, probably since you've been there. But I was interested because it seems that as a large institution like the University of Illinois, you really could actually have gone either way or done both things.
Yeah, certainly. And in fact, in hindsight, I was just kind of stupid. I went to somebody, I can't even remember who this was. I went to some, I think it was the district attorney in Bond County,
okay,
to get career advice. You know, because when you're in high school, they're like, go to other professionals and talk to them. So I did that. And he said, I want to do computers. And at that time, people are like, what do you mean you want to do computers? Like, well, you want to go into engineering. And engineering at the time was like electrical engineering and, right. you know, very serious engineering. There wasn't a lot of comp sci. There wasn't a lot of computer engineering. And so I said, well, I don't want to do that. I guess I'll go into economics. So I majored in economics and then I changed to history because I'm very interested in history. And then journalism school at the University of Illinois doesn't start until your junior year.
Okay.
So when I was in, I was already doing radio. And I thought, well, maybe I should just do a major that goes along with what I'm doing all the time anyway. It'll be easier on me. So I switched to journalism my junior year and got into the College of Communications that way. But in hindsight, there was a nascent computer science department at the University of Illinois, quite good one. In fact, Mark Andreessen was at the University of Illinois mm-hmm. developing Netscape. At the time that I was there, I just didn't know it. And it was just lack of research on my part. I didn't hit on the right person to tell me, well, these are the classes you need to take and this is the track you want to go in. So I ended up in journalism instead. But yeah, I mean, they were a node on the internet. Our journalism department benefited from it because we were set up with Gopher and Archie and all that stuff to do research on stories. I remember covering the Clinton Clinton Bush election in 92, and we were on Gopher, and it was amazing because we were like, wow, we get the itinerary of the candidates like right there, and you can just call it up. You don't have to phone anyone or get a fax or anything. It was amazing. And they also have at the University of Illinois, they have what's called the Plato Labs. I don't know if they still run it anymore, but it was the inspiration for HAL in 2001 A Space Odyssey. It was an artificial intelligence mainframe computer system with vector graphic terminals, and you would go down in the basement of the foreign language building and you could access Plato, and it would like teach you foreign languages.
Wow.
Amongst many other things. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of computer science stuff going on at the University of Illinois for sure.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Plato. I just sort of remembered as you were talking there, a family friend of my family, is actually the head of the Beckman Institute, and I believe that falls under his institute's research now.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah, Beckman was kind of new. They just spent a lot of money on a new building when I was there in the North Campus, and I know that it has grown tremendously since then.
Okay. Well, do you have anything else really like? Oh, like. If I wanted to tell someone like sort of the kernel of my success or my sort of gusto.
Plastics.
Yeah. Plastics.
No, I think I get what you're after. I mean, I get a lot of folks that will email and say, hey, I want to do what you do. I want to do technology journalism. I want to do podcasting. You know, I want to do all this stuff. What do I need to know? And that's hard advice because everyone I know who does this sort of stumbled into it one way or another. And I think that's the nature of all new things is that no one, you know, was born in 1970 and grew up saying, I want to be a podcaster because it didn't exist.
Right.
You just didn't know what it was. So to say, well, these are the things you need to do now to prepare is kind of weird. Like if I were to tell someone to prepare the way I did, I would say grow up liking computers and then don't really know what you want to do out of grad school and bum around for a long time until someone invents a technology that you're really interested in and then start doing that. But I think some of the things that benefited me along the way were always trying out new things and doing them as if they were serious. So the way I ended up getting the job at ZDTV.com was because I had been running subbrilliant.com as a real website. Mm-hmm. I was out there doing it already. So I was going on, I had writers submitting me stuff, I was editing them, I was on a regular publishing schedule, and I'd figured out how to do all these things. I'd created my own essentially talkback, like instant messages that could be posted on a story using some CGI and some Perl script. And when I interviewed, she, you know, the person who was hiring me asked me all of these questions about, you know, well, can you do this? Can you do that? And I was like, yeah, I mean, I haven't done it professionally, but this is, let me point to what I've been doing. This is Sobrilliant.com. This is Sobrilliant News. This is what, how I've done it. And, you know, these are things that I've invented, and I can do everything you want me to do, and I can do it for cheap or nothing because I've had to do it that way.
Right.
And she's like, that's beautiful. That's what I want, you know? And so, you know, it helped that it was the 90s and it was hard to find people at the time. So that kind of helped me get leads.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially I had been doing what they wanted me to do already on my own. And I think that's always attractive to someone. I know when I'm hiring folks, I look at like, well, what are your projects? What do you do? How do you do it? And I listen to it, look at it. And so that's my advice to people. If you want to go into podcasting, start a podcast. It's the beautiful thing about the internet now is that you can just go do all of these things on your own and give them a shot. You know, start a blogger account if you want to be a gadget blogger and just start writing up things. Doesn't mean it has to be perfect, but just, you know, keep practicing and keep trying to push yourself to be better.
Right. So basically just you need to take the incentive to start doing what you want to do. And then you can point to your previous works and say, well, this is what I have done.
Yeah, you can. The old advice used to be get an internship, right? Because then you could point to something that you had experience. Because the old conundrum is you can't get a job without experience, and you can't get experience without a job. So if you get an internship, you're likely to be able to be hired and get some experience that you can point to later. Now, I think that's still good advice, but you don't have to go right into an internship. You can get experience on your own, and. You know, it's a little risky because if you make something that's really crappy and you point to it, people may go, "Ooh, yeah, I don't want that guy. He can't write at all." you know, so you do have to be doing something that you really are passionate about so that comes through, and you have to improve. You have to be on yourself to get better. But I think that's an amazing opportunity that never existed before to easily go out and create things that are job-like.
Right. Okay. Eric, do you have anything you wanna add or ask or anything?
No, it totally makes sense. You know, especially like I said, stuff that didn't exist. And that's, I find that a lot in, especially in school districts, the current you know, technology directors or whatever fell into their position from something else because it wasn't really a big thing before. So no, it all makes sense.
Okay. with that, let's take a quick music break, and if you mind, Tom, we can talk a little bit more of some, you know, specifics of the tech industry today.
Sounds good.
All right. We'll be right back. we're back. This is the Digital Hazard on WRCT Pittsburgh, the 10th of April. We're here with Tom Merritt again.
Hello.
Hello. So if you want to turn towards some specifics of the tech industry today, I know you mentioned on Tech News Today, and I think it was on Buzz Out Loud and a bunch of other tech news and other news stories about how the House is moving to overturn, they have moved to overturn, sorry, the FCC's net neutrality proposition. Do you want to comment more on that and sort of like what net neutrality means for small content creators like you and I or Twit and CNET?
Yeah, net neutrality is really complicated. And you're right. What happened this week is that the House of Representatives voted to overturn the FCC's proposed guidelines. Mm-hmm. And this is why the whole thing is so complicated, because what's happened is the FCC published or proposed some guidelines. They haven't actually published them in the Federal Register yet. So the guidelines aren't actually in effect. In fact, Verizon and MetroPCS and a few others had brought a lawsuit that was thrown out of court because you can't bring a lawsuit to sue against guidelines that aren't in effect yet.
Right.
You have to wait until they go into effect. But that hasn't stopped the House of Representatives from saying, we're going to take a preventative measure and say that the FCC does not have the authority to do this and prevent their guidelines from going into effect. Now, that would have to be approved by the U.S. Senate and then signed by the president. The White House has indicated that, again, it's all so political, but
right.
The White House has indicated that the senior advisors will recommend to the president that he veto, which is short of saying the president will absolutely veto any bill like that. But it all comes down to the idea of internet providers being able to prefer certain traffic over others. And some people take the very strong objection that internet providers should never prefer any kind of traffic over anything else. That's what's made the internet great, is that you can access any content you want once you're connected to the internet without anyone getting in the way. On the other side, the ISP is saying, we have to manage traffic. We have to build out new ways of making money off of our pipes that we built. And the only way for us to do that is to charge people more for preferential delivery. And if we can't do that, we won't be able to build out the internet, and
right.
You won't have an internet anymore. So those are the two extreme sides of the argument. But where it comes down to is the idea that if, for instance, you want to stream your podcast onto the internet right now, you'll get best effort delivery. You'll get your podcast delivered to folks when they request it.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as they're paying for enough bandwidth, they should get it. What net neutrality advocates fear is that in a world where, say, AT&T allows NBC and Google to pay for faster delivery, your podcast might suffer. In other words, you wouldn't be able to be delivered in a timely fashion. You wouldn't be able to go on and do a live stream yourself. You wouldn't be able to roll it yourself because all of this other bandwidth would be preferred and you'd be stuck in the slow lane. And they would never update that slow lane. So as bandwidth got better and better, it would all be given to the paying providers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what everybody fears.
Right. I know sort of everyone talks about... Eric and I have made this comparison many times before, but we are really going to sort of look back on 2010 as the marker where, like, oh, that was the good old days of the internet. And from here on out, things are just sort of going to be different, and depending on who you are, different in a bad way, different in a good way. Do you see where I'm getting with this?
Oh, yeah. I felt that way in 1994. I said, this graphical web, they're putting advertisements on websites now. It's ruining it. All the companies are coming in. The Usenet conversations are going to dry up. The internet will never be the same. And it hasn't. And mostly that's been fine.
Right.
We've found other ways around it. And I think the problem with the net neutrality debate is that it's really centered around the wrong things. It's been hijacked by political interests. And so there's all of this crazy talk of like, if net neutrality regulations go into place, then freedom on the internet is crushed. And it's like the government telling you what you can and can't say, which is just incredible doublespeak because, you know, in its purest form, net neutrality is saying no one should tell anyone that their bits are more important than another. You should be free to say whatever you want. On the other side, I think ISPs have a very good argument that they that net neutrality regulations could go awry if written by political entities. If the FCC or Congress or anybody else comes in and says these are the rules of net neutrality that we're going to enforce, there's going to be unintended consequences, and you're likely to squash innovation and new technologies because they run afoul of net neutrality regulations. I mean, it is good to prefer video traffic over email traffic because video traffic streaming needs to be delivered in a timely fashion in order to keep the stream consistent and be able to view a streaming video. Whereas email, if it gets delayed by a few milliseconds, it doesn't matter at all. You don't notice. Your email delivers. But when you say that, people get freaked out because they're saying, oh, but how can you tell it's video? And I don't want my emails delayed. It's like we're talking about network management, not content management. So if you can say like, okay, that protocol that kind of packet is going to be delivered, you know, in a little more of a preferential fashion, but there's a timeout where your email actually has to get delivered within milliseconds, you're never going to notice. And that kind of network management isn't bad, but it's the kind of thing that could develop into some amazing way of handling bandwidth. We might be able to deliver high bandwidth applications over copper wires because of somebody coming up with a great algorithm for deciding when to prefer certain traffic over others. And net neutrality could make that illegal if the law was written badly. Right. What everybody wants is the ability for anyone in the United States or around the world, and frankly, anyone in the world, to be able to connect a device to the internet and use it and get the bandwidth that they're paying for.
Right.
And where the debate should be is how do we make sure that you have the choice to do that? How do you make sure that there's enough ISPs out there that if some ISP starts to be abusive and starts to downgrade things and certain sites that you like, certain blogs that you like aren't delivered in a timely fashion, that you can cancel that ISP and go to another because you're like, forget it. I love SB Nation and SB Nation isn't paying AT&T. Well, screw it. I'm going to go over to Verizon and I'm going to use them instead. And I think that's when I talk about net neutrality in short term on Tech News Today, I say that any legislation or any attention or any regulation needs to be about competition, and it needs to be about antitrust and making sure that we actually have a choice between providers. Because if we do, there will always be an ISP that's willing to say, hey, I'm going to deliver you the open internet, and I'm only going to charge you for a reasonable amount of what you use. I'm not going to try to double charge you. I'm not going to throw in unreasonable caps as a way to squeeze dimes out of you.
Right. And actually, I completely agree. I definitely follow your logic. And just the main crux of your argument here is choice. And I just immediately jump to AT&T T-Mobile. And I really, yes, the argument is, well, if AT&T and T-Mobile get together, then you have one GSM carrier and two, like one main GSM carrier and two main CDMA characters. So you carriers. So you still
they're
have
characters, a, all right. Characters.
carriers. So you theoretically still have a choice. But say I'm restricted in what I want to use. Say I'm a international businessman and I really only want to have one phone and go anywhere with it. Well, now I no longer have a choice because my circumstances have limited me to a GSM phone and I only have one GSM carrier.
Well, that's you know, I mean, that presupposes that Verizon and Sprint, who use CDMA right now, don't deliver any world phones, and they do. Verizon has phones that are world capable. The iPhone is one of them. It can be a CDMA and GSM phone. It's not right now, but they do deliver BlackBerries that have the GSM bands in them, so that when you travel around the world, you can use it. It's why Verizon is actually the most popular business phone, because it has the reputation of being the most reliable signal in the United States, and it has decent world phones. Problem with Verizon is their phones have never been very attractive. Mm-hmm. They've been workmanlike. And that's why they're popular with business, because, you know, a lot of business people don't really care about the bells and whistles. They just want a phone that works.
Well, for the longest time, I would see Verizon load their operating system onto these phones. This was sort of pre-iPhone, smartphone bubble. And it was like, it doesn't matter what phone you get from Verizon. It all has the same operating system. This seems really silly to me. It's like, why would I It's like, why would I actually want phone A over phone B if it's just all the same, and it's all...
And AT&T does that to Android now.
I'm aware.
Really? You didn't learn from any of this?
Eric, were you going to say something?
I actually was. Jumping back just a little bit to, you know, we prefer video traffic over, you know, email traffic. A lot of people don't realize that's already done today.
Yeah.
You know, with VoIP. You know, the telephone company where I used to work for, it's an IP switch. So as soon as your analog call hits that IP telephony switch, it goes out in packets to the other, you know, telcos. And so that is already, that quality of service routing is already taking place. And people just don't know it, you know, so it's not really so much of a new thing as an extension of that practice.
And I think that's one of the legitimate complaints ISPs have against legislation, is that things that they're already doing right now that aren't controversial could become illegal with poorly written legislation.
Right. It's just, you know, it boggles the mind that, you know, it's such a sad thing that this wonderful idea can be taken and then twisted, and then it becomes this horrendous debate.
Yeah, I think it's because it ends up being written by people who don't understand the actual issue. You know, the actual problem. You're not having it written by network engineers. You're having it written by lawyers.
Exactly. So that was what I wanted to sneak in there before we moved on to anything, Matt.
Oh, okay. That's plenty good. Good discussion. So you just mentioned Android, and I wanted to, that was one of my next bullet points here. So obviously Android versus iOS in the mobile space is a highly contested debate, and I'm not going to ask you where you lie. But I guess what I'm asking, or what I want to ask here, is how do you see this progressing? How do you see this one-upmanship bouncing back and forth between Google and its alliances with hardware manufacturers and carriers versus Apple with their own hardware and their alliance, which is on the rocks, I would say, with AT&T and their newfound alliance with Verizon? And then sort of, how do you scale this up? So we start with the iPhone, and then you get all these smartphones, and then you bounce back and say, oh, now the consumer market needs tablets, which, as an interesting side note, I mean, the majority of tablets sold are iPads. The market doesn't seem to know what I would need a tablet for, except for the people who have already gone out and bought an iPad. And then you get to sort of OS X Lion, which has all this integration of iOS versus the Chrome operating system, which we see on the CR48.
So what's your question?
How do you see this one-upmanship bouncing back and forth in the next five years or so?
Well, I don't see it as one-upmanship. I guess that's really why I'm having a hard time answering. It's just competition, and I think that's a fantastic thing. I think, you know, we got used to a world where everything was Windows except for a few crazy people who used OS X or Linux. and I think what we've got now is actually a narrowing of competition. In some ways, I'm I'm rooting more for the WebOS's and the Windows Phone 7 and the BlackBerry OS's because I want there to be more choice. I want there to be more competition. Android has been a fantastic thing in bringing along a lot of choice, a lot of different ways of having a smartphone, and applying pressure to iOS to stay vigilant. And Apple's done a great job. You can ask me what side I lie on. I use an iPhone right now, but that doesn't mean I think the iPhone is the be-all end-all. Android has great phones, and they've been getting better and better. I ordered a BlackBerry Playbook as well because I think it handles multitasking better than any other tablet operating system I've seen. I think the battery life is going to be a big problem with that. But I don't like to play fanboy. I don't like to pick a side and say I'm going to root for iOS no matter what. I just want gadgets that work. And no gadget is without its downside, and no gadget is without its upside, except mm-hmm. for maybe the Twitter peak, which is an entirely useless gadget. But most gadgets have their upsides, and so I think this is great. I think what we're seeing is people trying lots of stuff, and you put it as like, well, Apple came out with the iPhone, and then Android came out with phones, and then Apple came out with the iPad, and now there's Android tablets, and then there's the CR48, sort of this back and forth. But that's been going on long before. Asus came out with the EPC and kind of kicked off this whole idea of mobile computing before iOS was even thought of, or tablets were even thought of as a possibility. Mm-hmm. And tablets have come in and said, you know what? We think a tablet actually does what an EPC does better. And a lot of people are like, but I don't have a keyboard. Netbooks have become larger in response to that. So the folks who want a keyboard get a lighter netbook or a lighter laptop with a bigger screen. And they're not called netbooks anymore. They're still called thin and light laptops. But we're seeing those from Sony. We're seeing them from Samsung. And of course, the MacBook Air is the prettiest and most expensive of the bunch. But they're amazing. And so, I think what we're finding is a big explosion of different kinds of gadgets because we have competition among people again. Instead of Microsoft being the ones determining, we're going to do a tablet and it's going to have a stylus and it's going to run on a big bulky machine. And here you go. Tablet computing begin. And people are like, I don't really want that. And I have no other choice. Apple came in and said, we're really good at focusing on what people want instead of dictating what they want. And so we're going to come up with the iPad, and no one's going to think it's going to succeed. But because we figured out something by doing the iPhone, we're going to kick off a whole new revolution. And I think Android's catching up. The Zoom and those other tablets are bulky. They're a little buggy. But again, they're going to catch up, and they're going to be better, and they're going to be competitors. And there'll be a space for tablets. There'll be a space for thin and light laptops. But when you take a step back from all of this and you look at it and you stop looking at the ping pong, what you see is we don't have desktop computers anymore. We have desktop appliances that we need for certain things, like servers, like mm-hmm. video game machines, and still in the enterprise as a legacy for people who don't need to do anything but check email and do Microsoft Word. They've got a desktop at their desk, and then they go home and they leave it alone. But computing has become mobile. More and more business places are issuing laptops because they want people to be able to take it home and be able to access their work computers from home. And people are moving tablets into the enterprise because they fit certain niches, and smartphones as well. So I think what we're seeing is a good product of competition.
And Tom, I think you had an excellent segue into something I wanted to talk about too, is how do you feel about cloud computing and your data not being local anymore, but rather up in that cloud atmosphere?
People get really fearful about cloud computing the same way they get fearful about self-driving cars. It's all about control, right? Your hard drive in your laptop, your hard drive in your network attack storage is just as likely or more likely to crash and lose all your data as a cloud computing company is to go out of business or lose your data. In fact, the cloud computing company is less likely to lose your data in a crash because they have the wherewithal to be redundant and make good backups and protect your data. And so the big fear is like, well, yeah, but now they have my data and they can look at it and somebody could steal it. And I guess that's true more than, you know, they can't do that if it's in your house. But if you have your data attached to any network anywhere, you're vulnerable anyway. And there's lots of ways people can steal your data. Somebody could break into your house. So there are risks to everything you do. My feeling is the benefits of cloud storage and cloud computing are going to far outweigh the negatives, and it's going to become the way we live. We're going to live in the cloud. The internet is becoming more and more, you know, all this net neutrality aside, I think we're going to figure it out, and we're going to have high bandwidth, ubiquitous access. And I already live in the cloud in a lot of ways that I never could have imagined doing, like Google Docs, or things like Pandora, where I just, you know, oh, my music is now in the cloud. I don't even have to own it anymore. And I think that's going to happen more and more. I also think it's going to be important to have local backups of your data. That's important. And so I think there are going to be a lot of good services that provide you that redundancy where you have a network attached storage that keeps a local copy of the really important data that you have that you don't want to lose, just in case a company did have a catastrophe or a hacker broke in and wiped stuff out. But again, I don't think those risks in the cloud are any different than the risks you have managing data locally on your own stuff, and probably less risky in most ways if you really took a step back. It's just that we don't like the idea of it not being there under our control. If our hard drive breaks in our house, we only have ourselves to blame, right? Mm-hmm. So we feel like, well, that won't happen to me because I'm such an elite expert manager. I will never lose my data because I'm in control. And that may be true for you. But when you step back and just look at it as a sociological problem, your data probably is safer in the cloud.
Those are really good points. I agree with everything you said. My concern that I have personally is connectivity, you know, the ability to be able to access that. You know, I used to be on Altel with my phone, and it was amazing the signal coverage difference I got once I actually, Verizon bought Altel, and then I switched to an actual Verizon phone. I had so much better coverage, but I still find spots where, I don't have access to that 3G, to that network. My best example being the GPS app on my phone. It downloads the maps live, and if I'm going somewhere and I don't have signal, all of a sudden I don't have my GPS anymore. So I don't think we'll be able to truly move to a 100% solution, and we may never move to 100% in the cloud solution until we solve that connectivity issue.
Yeah, ubiquitous connectivity has to happen for us to go 100%. And I think you're right. I don't think it's safe to go 100%. I think you always have to have some amount of redundancy and backup. I mean, that's what I recommend right now, is that you should back up to the cloud with some kind of cloud service, and you should back up locally on network attached storage so that you have three copies of your data at all time. You have your copy on your computer, you have a copy in the cloud, you have a copy locally, and that way you're pretty well protected. And I think that'll always be true.
Cool.
I was going to make a point when you were talking about sort of living in the cloud, and I actually had a personal experience just happened yesterday or 2 days ago. I was backing up my documents off of my computer onto an external hard drive, and I was like, you know, I guess I don't need to copy over my music collection because I recently uploaded it all to Amazon's like cloud player. And it was one of those like, oh wow, I guess the cloud really has taken over my life more than I thought it had.
Because you felt like you didn't need to have a copy of it locally anymore.
Well, I didn't need to have a backup of my local copy.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think that's dangerous thinking.
I guess, but
again, of things like music, right? Because if Amazon decides to start charging for that backup, then what do? You have to pay them, or you have to pull it all back down and put it on a local drive. Whereas if you already still have it stored locally, that's not as big of a deal. So I think there's always going to be that essence of control that I'm talking about, that we're going to have to get used to. And maybe it's just companies or legislation that guarantees access to data. You know, there's sort of a Federal Trade Commission understanding of when you go into cloud storage, what that means. I don't think that happens for another 50 or 100 years where it becomes so standard that, you know, you have a consumer protection law around cloud data. But yeah, you have to be careful with it now, because you have to trust the company. Hate Bad Design on Twitter is taking me to task. He's like, you're burying the lead. It's about people stealing your data. And he's right. You have to trust that the company is going to secure your data, and it's not going to get stolen, and they're not going to go out of business or change the terms to where you can't afford to store it with them anymore.
Okay. But you raise a point, or it clicked in my mind about sort of governmental regulation of this, in that, I mean, we talked about it not that long ago, but do you feel that sort of the internet industry, as in things that are on the internet, businesses that have their service on the internet, as opposed to a physical service like plumbing or something, that they grow, like their life cycle can grow and die and be reborn in the amount of time it takes for the governmental procedure that would regulate this growth or this service to even begin to be thought about or begin to be taken in like hard written words.
Yeah. By the time the government actually figures out what cloud storage means, we've moved on to something else. We'll have mesh storage, where little bits of your data are stored in a mesh network across thousands of computers, and you've got your data secure because no one knows where it actually is except you, because there's a public and a private key, and it's distributed around the internet redundantly, so that even if somebody unplugs their computer, it doesn't matter because it's all distributed. And we'll finally have cloud storage rules for Google Docs, and everybody like, nobody uses that anymore. it's a very good point. That's why I said I don't think we end up with consumer protection laws till 50 or 100 years from now, simply because it has to become so ubiquitous that every single person uses it and is familiar with it and has even grown up with it before the government can feel like they can safely regulate it. Not that they won't try to regulate it before that, but there will be enough opposition to that sort of thing. But, you know, we don't consider bad consumer protection laws against food, because everybody grows up eating food, and right, we know the importance of food that doesn't poison us. So everybody agrees on that. The debate around things like cloud usage are going to take a lot longer to mature. That's a really good point.
Okay. Well, then we have about 12 minutes left here. So let's just do some social networking talk, if you will. It was in the news.
At reply, LOL.
Oh my gosh.
Mokes.
It was announced in the news this week about the Obama-Zuckerberg town hall, where both of them are going to field questions. I think it's the 20th of April.
I imagine them with gloves and the questions being rolled to them.
Really?
People say they're going to field questions. I wish that they would actually do that. Like, you write your question on a baseball, and then you just toss it.
But I guess you'd have to have like good aim if you.
Well, you throw grounders.
Throw grounders? Okay.
Yeah, because they're fielding them.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. And they're not going to get the coach to just hit grounders?
The president really booted that question. EP.
Oh, dear.
Sorry, I didn't mean to distract you.
No, it's fine. I mean, anyone can go and listen to your opinion on this on your show, but more the point I'm getting at here is more of the politics here. We were just talking about this. The politics of getting on the internet. I mean, obviously, it was really the Obama generation that the generation that sort of came of age to vote for Obama in 2008 that started mobilizing via the internet, via Facebook, via Twitter, via probably MySpace to an extent, although now we know MySpace is dead in the water. But
I just logged into MySpace earlier today, actually, and I went to a friend's page to look up something, and she has put "I don't live here anymore" as her latest blog entry, and it was from 2009. I find that quite telling.
I do. Yeah. Okay. So.
Yeah. What was your question, Matt?
What was my question? That's a very good question. I don't know. Just want to comment on the way that social media these days, things on Facebook, things is sort of spread through social networking, how that impacts our perception of the news these days. I mean, even with Egypt and Libya and prior to that, governmental instances where the social network was the main way of disseminating information. I mean, people go to twitter.com/CNN more than they go to CNN.com.
So I hear that a lot. And Republicans get really mad when you say it was the Obama generation that pioneered the internet, because there was a lot of stuff going
on. That's not
on
what
the
I'm
McCain,
saying, but
McCain side of the campaign as well. Mm-hmm. But
the Obama organization definitely did
have a lot of grassroots organizing around Twitter and Facebook, and they did it well. And I think they deserve credit for that. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, when you talk about Egypt and the other in Tunisia and Libya, I think we overestimate how much effect social networking had, because it had an effect. And so we tend to want to say, wow, these new tools had an effect, therefore they're responsible for the revolution. Absolutely not. Okay, from what I know, and I wasn't on the ground there, but from a lot of what I've read, the revolution happened in a very traditional manner, with people talking to each other and in person and organizing. Especially when Egypt cut off the internet, it didn't stop the revolution because they weren't able to socially network. What Facebook and Twitter did was two things. They allowed an extra arm of communication so that you could get the message out a little wider than you would have by foot.
Better
by
dissemination
phone.
Of information.
Yeah, it was an extra way to disseminate information. So the pool got a little wider, it seems. And it provided a way for the world to watch what was happening. And I think that's what was really impressive, because you were able to watch what was happening in a way that you couldn't. You still needed good curation of what was happening, because it was a mess. It was the other thing that Twitter showed, was if you just look at a random sampling of people in Egypt talking about the revolution, A, how do you know they're actually in Egypt? B, how do you know what they're saying is true? And C, how do you know that what they think is true is actually representative of what's really going on in such a fluid, dynamic situation? And we had good curation. Andy Carvin from NPR was a fantastic curator of this, and a real pioneer in social media journalism, by selecting trusted sources that he knew or could verify and retweeting them, so that you were getting those original voices, but you were getting them vetted by somebody who was on the ground and knew. So if you trusted A. Carvin, then you trusted that he was passing along good stuff. And then that's when it became fascinating. And so you're getting these voices of people saying, you know, they're moving into the square and we're holding firm, or the rumor has come down that Mubarak will resign tomorrow. And we heard it from this person. And that was an incredible way to follow what was going on. But I still wanted live coverage. And so I was streaming Al Jazeera all the time as well, because you wanted to see what was happening and get it immediately. And live streaming video, I think, is unparalleled in that manner of when an event is happening right that second. What social media gave was the wider context and the feelings of people on the ground that I don't think we could have ever gotten before.
Okay, yeah, I see how that's fair. That's fair to say. Definitely. Well, we've got about 5 minutes left, so do Eric, do you have anything on your mind? 5 minutes worth of discussion here?
I guess we had talked briefly earlier about the Epsilon breach, and maybe we don't want to talk specifically about that event, but that type of event happening where their trust is held. And we kind of touched on it with the cloud companies, but you know, today with everybody trusting, you know, so many things to places on the internet, you have online banking, you know, you have online shopping, all these things. I guess maybe any sorts of tips or pointers to people on how to, you know, what should they do to keep their information safe? And
that's a really good point, because security on the internet is far from perfect. And I think you could overestimate the damage of the Epsilon breach, because they did only get names and email addresses. So the information they got alone isn't so damaging, but it's what they can use it to do. They can use it to pretend to be Best Buy, saying, hey, you need to reconfirm your membership in BestBuy.com. Just click here. Mm-hmm. So the standard advice still applies. Don't open attachments in email from anyone ever. If someone is claiming that you need to click on a link because of some urgent problem, don't click on it. If you think, you know, read it very skeptically. And if you think that it might be true, go in a separate browser window directly to the company and log in and see if you get the message yourself. Don't click on things from email that are urging you to take action right away. Good example, my wife got an email from PayPal. Actually, no, not from PayPal, from one of our credit cards that said that three attempts had been made to log in to our credit card's account from different computers, and that the account would be suspended if we did not click on this link right away. And the link said, you know, the name of the credit card.com. Well, it was a phishing expedition. It was somebody who was going to redirect you by masking the URL in the email address. And the fact of the matter is, the credit card company isn't going to send you an email saying, click on this link to restore access to an account that we think might be compromised. That's not how they would do it. They would probably suspend your account, and when you tried to log in, say, call a phone number, and then you would call the credit card company and try to restore access that way by giving them a chance to verify who you are. So don't open attachments. Don't click on links that are suspicious. And use strong passwords. And if you can, use different email addresses for your different accounts. Google in Gmail provides a really easy way to do this. You put a plus sign after your actual username. You can append different things so that you know where this email address is coming from. For instance, if I'm signed up with Groupon for something, I can make my email address Tom Merritt plus Groupon. And then I know if I get an email to that address that it was Groupon that handed that email along, and it's not some legitimate thing. That way, if somebody got the Epsilon data and started spamming me and said, hey, I'm your credit card company, and it came to, you know, Tom Merritt plus Groupon, I'm like, oh, you just, I mean, the Groupon wasn't stolen in Epsilon, but I would know, like, oh, you just hacked in and stole that email address. And then I skipped over it way too quickly, but strong passwords, different passwords for every site. Do not use the same password for everything. If you have to, if you're like, that's too hard for me, use a password manager. A really good one is called LastPass. It's absolutely free to use in most situations. You can pay to get some more features, or 1Password. Is one that I use on OS X, where you pay to download the program, but you don't have to pay for any of the other management, and it does share your passwords to other devices, again, encrypted with your permission. But it'll generate passwords and help you remember them. The longer the password, the better. Use capital letters and alphanumeric characters and all of that kind of stuff. I'm not saying that all those tips will keep you perfectly safe, but those are some.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much, Tom. If you want to find out more about Tom, go over to twit.tv and just look for Tech News Today.
Twit.tv/TNT, or you can go to tommerritt.com.
Okay. As always, you can find this show on our blog, thedigitalhazard.tk. If you want to email us, please do thedigitalhazard@wrct or call in and leave us a voicemail 412-294-TDHP. That's 8347. Thank you very much, Tom, for being on.
My pleasure.
With that, I'm Matt Barron.
And I'm Eric Boyer.
Reminding you to beware the digital hazard.
You are listening to a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. Any opinions expressed within are solely those of the participants and do not reflect the views of WRCT Radio Incorporated. Questions and comments can be addressed to the Public Affairs Director at pa@wrct.org or by calling 412-621-0728.